Hey guys, and welcome to episode 63 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now, in this episode, I got Alan Wegg on the podcast. Alan is a therapist and he treats people with OCD. He runs a clinic in New Jersey and he is an affiliate of the IOCDF. And I got him on because he wrote a book about using storytelling in the treatment of OCD. Now, he's not saying storytelling itself will help people recover. But what he is saying, which I found very interesting, is the use of storytelling can help people understand key concepts in therapies such as ERP or CBT. And I think that's great because sometimes, you know, especially clinicians and psychologists, they study hard, they're academic, they're very intelligent people usually. And they learn all these big terms, and talking about these terms, cognitive dissonance, diffusion, all this stuff, psychological flexibility, and you mention it to a client, someone who's there for therapy, and it might just go over their head because that's not their schooling, they've never read anything about it, so why would they get it? And I like the way Alan uses stories to make it. Like these big concepts make them completely relatable and understandable to the client. And I think that's a very powerful thing. And storytelling is something I believe in clearly because of the name of this podcast and site, the OCD Stories. I believe we learn our history through the use of storytelling. Before we had books and stuff, we would have been sitting around fires as cavemen and cave women sharing stories. And that's kind of how we learn and shared histories together. So I think storytelling is important, and the book's really good, and I encourage you to check it out if you want to and can. But yeah, Alan shares some great advice in this episode. And without further ado, check out Alan. I hope you enjoy this episode and it is of service to you. Speak to you soon. On today's show, I have Dr. Alan Wegg. Alan is a licensed psychologist and founder of the Stress and Anxiety Services of New Jersey. He's on the board of directors for OCD New Jersey, an affiliate of the IOCDF, and he wrote the book OCD Treatment Through Storytelling. Welcome to the podcast, Alan.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. I came across the idea of OCD Treatment Through Storytelling through one of the videos you did on YouTube. And I just found it quite a captivating idea. And obviously this podcast is called the OCD Stories, so I thought it fit nicely. So we got some questions, a few questions from sort of people with OCD and a few questions of my own. But I guess before we get into that, it'd be good to hear how you got into treating OCD patients and why you did, I guess.
Well, I used to work at a mental health center, which is basically a public clinic. And all kinds of people come in to these centers and get assigned to different therapists on staff. But because I identified myself as a cognitive behavioral therapist, I got a lot of the clients, like I prefer clients rather than patients. I got a lot of the clients that presented with anxiety disorders. And so pretty much anybody that came into the clinic that had OCD came my way. And I found myself very intrigued with this particular subset of anxiety difficulties, I think really for a couple of reasons. One was because they presented sometimes looking really psychotic, really crazy. They said and did things and even had reported having thoughts that sounded totally bizarre, which at first glance, at first listen, sounded, you know, really psychotic. Yeah. But when you get to understand how this works, and then you see the kind of people they are, they're very, very not psychotic. They're regular people who just happen to have these strange thoughts that are kind of separate from them. And I liked that kind of dichotomy about really looking very impaired in certain ways psychiatrically, but really not being. The other thing that I found very intriguing is that in pretty much most or even all, I would say, of the OCD presentations that I came across, I kind of recognized a little bit of myself in those things. You know, it wasn't completely foreign to me. I mean, everybody has weird, crazy thoughts every now and then. The real difference between people who don't have OCD and people who do is that people with OCD get stuck. You know, like, they can't just sort of say, oh, that's a weird thought and kind of move on. Yeah. But the familiarity of it struck me also in ways that a lot of other disorders didn't necessarily.
Yeah, no, so that's, yeah, I agree. So it's obviously something I've struggled with, but also I'm studying a master's now in mental health, and OCD I find to be one of the most fascinating of the conditions or disorders or whatever you want to call it. Okay, cool. So I guess, you know, how do stories help in your treatment of OCD? If you give us an example of that.
Oh, well, you know, first of all, how that all started was OCD is it's weird. It's just, it's very unusual. It's very bizarre. It's very difficult for people to understand what is going on for their family members. And it's very sometimes very difficult for the person to understand themselves what's actually going on. And more so than that, the treatment is very, very strange. In fact, when people first come in to see me, one of the things I say to them is, you think your thoughts are really bizarre. You think the things you do are really weird and crazy. Wait until you see what the therapy is all about. Because the therapy is more crazy looking than the problem, unless you understand what it is that you're doing and why you're doing this kind of therapy and how it actually works. So, you know, I found sometimes it was very difficult to explain to family members the experience that the person was having, the person with OCD, like what that was like. And I also sometimes found it difficult to explain certain concepts as to how to think about the OCD, how to think about your relationship with the OCD, and how to think about the therapy. And so I would just kind of come up with a metaphor, a story to kind of get a point across. And then, the client or the family member would say, oh, I get it. I see what you're talking about. And I would say to myself, gee, that's a good way to kind of get that point across. I'd make a note about this little metaphor, this little story that I just kind of came up with on the spot to explain a certain concept. And then I found myself doing that with more and more ideas having to do with what is the experience of having OCD and what is the treatment all about in terms of having OCD. And at a certain point, I had about 60, 70 stories, and there was the book. It was already written.
Wow. Yeah, no, that's, yeah, I like that. And I guess
it was a very organic process. Yeah. I didn't sit down to write the book. It just kind of evolved over really more than a decade of time.
Yeah, that's, yeah, the best ideas are that way, right? And I guess it makes sense because we as humans have told or learned through stories over the years. It's how history was passed on before we started writing things down. So, yeah. It would be good. What I'll do is I'll link in the show notes for anyone listening where they can find. You've done some great sort of storytelling on your YouTube channel. So I'll link to those videos.
Oh, yes, thank you.
But what would be good is if you could maybe highlight one or two stories as an example for the listeners around a key OCD.
Oh, sure. Sure. So, you know, when I talk about the main therapy, the main concept, of exposure therapy, for instance, just a kind of very brief, kind of a shortened version of the story because of time here. You know, the thing about the therapy itself, it's all about, you know, facing your fears. It's all about what I call flying into the darkness, so moving in the direction that is outside of your comfort zone. And it's very hard to do that. But one of the things we try to emphasize is the idea that if you do exposure therapy repeatedly over time, that your own experience of anxiety and the difficulty that you have in doing whatever act you're doing becomes easier. It becomes less difficult over time. And that's just a matter of repetition. So the story that I tell is, you know, when I do this in presentations, I'll say, you know, so you and I, Stuart, are friends, and you asked me to go to the movies, and I'm so excited that you asked me to go to the movies with you that I don't even ask you what movie are we going to. And so we go, and we're walking, and we're talking, and we pay for our tickets, and we go into the theater, and I'm so engaged in conversation with you that I still don't pay attention to what movie we're going to see. And we go in, and we sit down, and the movie starts. And the movie is one of those adolescent horror movies where there's lots of blood and killing and horrific scenes. And the movie starts right away with a particularly shocking scene, just to kind of grab the attention of the audience. Now, in the story that I'm telling you, you, Stuart, love these kind of movies, but I hate them. They freak me out. So I see this first scene. I get very anxious. I get up. I run out of the movie theater into the lobby. You run after me, and you say, Alan, I really want you to watch the movie with me. And I'm like, I don't think I can do this. It's just overwhelming for me. I don't like that kind of stuff. And you say, I really want to just share it with you. And so, you know, you look around the lobby and you say, look, I'll buy you one of those big buckets of popcorn with extra butter if you come and watch the movie with me. And so, you know, I'm really into the junk food. And so I say yes. And I go in and I watch with you. And I watch the whole movie with you. I don't cover my eyes. I pay attention the whole time. And I'm having a really, really hard time doing it. You know, I'm shaking, I feel nervous, I'm perspiring, I feel lightheaded. It's really a difficult experience for me. And at the end of the movie, you turn to me and you say, that was a great movie. Let's watch it again. And I say, no way, that was really difficult for me. But let's say you convince me, you know, you buy me a big candy bar and I stay for a second movie. And then we stay for a third movie. You know, the same movie. Three times in a row, like a marathon. And then the next day you call me up and we get together and we watch it three more times. And the next day, three more times. And the next day, three more times. So during this 4-day period of time, we watched the movie 12 times. And I usually ask people, so do I respond to the movie the 12th time the way that I did to the first time, as I did in the first time? And the answer is, of course, no. And what's the reason? Usually the answer is, you kind of got used to it. You know what's going to happen. It's not so much of a surprise. And the answer is that that's the truth, that it is easier for me to watch it. I may get bored with it. I won't like it necessarily the way that you do, but I don't get that visceral, guttural reaction. My body doesn't respond the same way. It just kind of wears on me in that way. That's desensitization. You know, the word sensitive is there. I become less sensitive to it, or habituation becomes habit-like. Now, there's some research, by the way, that kind of shows that sometimes the anxiety doesn't even really go down, but people kind of acclimate to it. So the anxiety's there, but it doesn't bother them in the same way as it did in the very beginning. Well, that's what exposure therapy is all about. And so when we talk about the need to do a lot of repetition in the therapy session, I'll just say, it's like going to the horror movie. Remember, it's like going to the horror movie. And that name, going to the horror movie, is really communicating this whole idea of you just have to need to do it over and over and over again, and it's really going to be okay. It's not going to be like this all the time. It's just in the very beginning that it's really very, very difficult. And just as a side note, one of the stories I almost always tell right after that one is a lot of people say, well, that sounds fine, and so I understand that, but I don't want to go through what you went through when you watched that movie the first time. It's too scary for me. And that's when we talk about the swimming pool story, which is essentially this idea that there's two ways of going into a swimming pool. One is the cannonball dive, where you tuck your knees into your chest and you throw your body over the deep end of the pool, and your whole body hits the water at once and you scream because it's so cold. But then you get used to it in 30 seconds. And the alternative is you walk down the steps very slowly and you let your feet get used to it, and then your knees get used to it and your thighs get used to it. It takes longer, but you have a lot more control over the process, and it's never quite the trauma that, you know, diving off at the deep end is, you know. And that's developed, this concept of developing a hierarchy with exposure. And so you do this flying into the darkness in terms of facing your fears, but you need to do it over and over and over again, like going to the horror movie. And if it's too overwhelming for you in the beginning, you can go into the swimming pool slowly and actually change the way in which you're doing exposure therapy. So you're getting acclimated one step at a time. And that's the language that we use in therapy when we use storytelling, if that helps to understand.
Yeah, absolutely, it does. I really like those examples, and it makes 100% sense to me, and I'm sure it will to the listeners. And also, I encourage anyone listening to get your book if they can, because I think you raise a lot of these questions, so you answer a lot of these questions in story form, and I think it makes a lot of sense.
Thanks very much.
No worries. So quick question from me before we get on to some, or a couple of questions before we get on to some user questions, is I'm big on finding sort of other things that help. So obviously, you know, things like ERP is massive and should be a huge part of someone's recovery. But have you noticed from your clients any other smaller things that help, you know, lifestyle changes, whether that's exercise, sleep, anything like that, that could be of service?
Well, We typically don't use like relaxation training or things of that sort in particular to treat OCD. However, the way that I would answer your question is by saying this. Like many other psychiatric and physical disorders, you may be more susceptible to stress. So if in general your life is stressed, it isn't actually, making you have OCD, but you already have OCD and your OCD will be exacerbated when you have a lot of stress. So, when people are going through difficulties at work, or they're being challenged in school, or they broke up with a girlfriend or boyfriend, or they're going through a divorce, or they're getting married and they're going on vacation. Anything that's a big change that creates stress, or when you get ill with the flu, or if you haven't slept for a few days, and so you're compromised in that way because you're experiencing sleep deprivation. Anything that compromises your mental and physical abilities makes it so that your OCD can become stronger. It's an opportunistic disorder. It takes every opportunity it can to express itself. And if it finds a weakness, that's when it'll strike. So, as a general rule of thumb, we tell people when you have OCD, you want to be taking better care of yourself. So, things like exercise and eating properly, nutrition, sleeping, getting the sleep that you need, having the right balance of fun and work, having really good relationships and making sure that they stay healthy. All those are part of the foundation by which you then appropriately treat the OCD. But I would never say that those things themselves are treatment for OCD. Do you hear the difference in that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that's really good advice. Okay, cool. So let's get on to some user questions. So Elk or Alki, I'm not sure how to say this, as apologies, I'm butchering your name. But she wants to know, what do you recommend OCD sufferers to do on their to do on their way to recovery or while still doing ERP to identify their red flags in order to design a coping plan for life after behavioral therapy? So I guess this is maybe a relapse question about noticing kind of what you said there, I guess, around stress and things like that.
Yeah, well, that's a big part of it. In fact, one of the things that I do during my kind of wrap-up sessions with people when they're ready to kind of end therapy with me on any kind of regular basis is we talk about the idea that at the beginning of every month that you sit down and you look at the month coming up and you see, are there any situations that I can anticipate may trigger my OCD? Now, of course, there's always going to be things that hit you that you didn't expect, but you prepare where you can. And so if you know that you're having something coming up, a big presentation, a trip that you're taking, that should be your cue to ask yourself the question, what do I need to do to A, pay closer attention to what might be early OCD warning signs for me? And then what will my response be? So to take a very typical example of usually when we talk about OCD, the one that everybody knows is the contamination and hand washing or avoidance kind of response. And so I often use that as an example because, quite honestly, that isn't even most of the cases that we see, because in my practice, we get a lot of the cases that a lot of other therapists are having trouble with. But they tend to be the more subtle or unusual expressions of OCD. But if we're talking about your standard classic, it would be, well, the kinds of things that all of a sudden you'll start to notice that you might not have thought about for a few weeks or a few months, that you think about, oh, that feels dirty or that looks dirty, or I might need to wash my hands if I touch that. I need to be careful what that touches, that sort of thing. And of course, the intervention is as soon as you recognize that you're thinking that and feeling that, you go for the jugular. That's the time to start holding that thing in your lap all the time and really rubbing your hands all over it and then touching everything else around the house. Because if it wasn't triggering you a week ago and all of a sudden now you're beginning to notice that you're becoming a little more sensitive to it, then you want to make sure that you kind of put those urges back in their place and that way of thinking back in its place. It's a way of just having your radar on and then being very aggressive in attacking those symptoms.
Yeah, no, I really like that. That's a good idea. And Matt wants to know around, so you talked about it earlier with the swimming pool story, but he wants to know when is flooding or pushing really hard on exposures acceptable?
That's a very individual choice. We talk about the SUDS level, subjective units of distress or subjective units of discomfort, SUDS. And we talk about anxiety on the scale of 0 to 10, where 10 is really, really like I need to go to the hospital kind of feeling, like I can't handle this, I'm getting a panic attack. And 0 is I'm not feeling any anxiety at all. So when I do exposure with people, when I instruct them to do exposure, I pretty much say to them, well, if you're doing a 1, 2, 3, or even 4, it's mild, but you're not really challenging yourself. That's sort of like going to the gym to kind of, build up your muscles and picking up a 2 pound weight and just lifting it over and over again. You're not going to build up a whole lot of muscle like that. On the other hand, if I choose something that's a 9 or a 10, that's going to really overwhelm me, and I might not feel up to doing that on a consistent basis. It's really hard to sustain that kind of exposure therapy on like a daily basis when it's torturous like that. It's like going to the gym and then, trying to pick up a 350-pound barbell when you haven't been working out. Even if you're able to do it, it'll be so difficult and be so strenuous on your body, you might need a few weeks to recover, and you're not going to come back on a regular basis. So what we try to do is look for that kind of sweet spot, that, that 5, 6, 7, 8 area where you're being challenged, you're building your strength, but it's manageable. The problem with doing this sort of implosive therapy is not that it doesn't work, because it does, but it's so toxic that, first of all, a lot of people won't agree to do it. Second, I don't know that it's necessary to do that. If you do it by going into the swimming pool a little slower, you're going to get to the same place, although it may take a little bit longer. But the experience does not have to be torturous. But if, and when people say to me sometimes, I really want to do this, I really want to jump into this thing, I'll warn them about things to be thinking about. Will you be able to sustain this? Is this going to be too much for you? But if they insist, I say fine, as long as there's nothing dangerous that you're doing, sure.
No, that seems like a sensible response. And then Basim wants to know, basically, when is enough effort in recovery enough? So I think she struggles a bit with of. I guess guilt around not doing enough, although it does sound like she's doing a lot, but it's kind of the belief system that she could always be doing more. So I guess what's the ideal amount of effort?
I mean, I'm hearing the question is, when do I know that I'm finished working on my OCD problem? Is that what the question is?
I guess, but from like a week to week basis, so how much in ERP, how much effort should one be putting in?
Right. Okay. This is a very individualized kind of thing. As a general rule of thumb, I tell people, you don't want your work with OCD to be, overwhelmingly stressful, that it affects your functioning in other areas of your life. And so there has to be some balance. I want people to move forward. I want people to really experience the discomfort of being out of their comfort zone and doing proper exposure therapy. But also, there's a lot of demands on people's time, and it's all about what you're able to sustain. If the question really has to do to when do I know that I'm at the point that I can kind of let up a little bit, that is also a very difficult question to answer in a very general way. I think there's always the risk of being perfectionistic and kind of OCD-ish about your OCD treatment. People will say, I want to completely eradicate my OCD. I don't want any part of it to exist. I'm going to do this and work really hard until this thing is done. And I think that there is a problem with that, because we don't say that we cure OCD. We say that we manage OCD. And once you're able to function well, and you're able to go to school and work and go any place you would normally go and enjoy yourself and be with friends and live your life relatively normally, there may still be this sort of background noise of your OCD nagging at you every now and then and bringing up a question or a concern that you can pretty much dismiss, but it's still there. And I think to expect a complete eradication makes you sort of a slave to this, holy grail of I need to completely eradicate the OCD. And so I usually tell people, let's get to a point where, you're really doing okay, and then we can kind of coast for a while.
Yeah, no, I like that. So we've got a few quick fire questions now. So you're in an elevator, let's say you're going up a few stories, a few floors, and someone notices that you're an OCD therapist, however, and they ask you, what advice do you have? What would you say to them in that sort of 30-second elevator ride?
I usually tell people I'm really not in a position to be able to give you any true psychological advice because I don't really know you, and everybody is an individual. And so I usually make the recommendation that, they either read up on it or they go and speak with another professional themselves. And of course, a lot of times when I do presentations, I have people come up afterwards and they kind of ask me questions. And, the theme is always the same. This is about not accommodating the OCD. This is about challenging the OCD. This is about always pushing up against it one step at a time in a regular, daily fashion. But it's hard to do this, and it really helps to have support. And it's really important to have good professional support, people who really know what they're doing.
Yeah, good advice. Okay, cool. So part of recovery, I believe, is about, knowing what you want to become or what you want to do or how you want to live your life. So I guess maybe taking the therapist hat off, as a one human to another, what advice do you have for someone who wants to live an amazing life?
That's a fascinating question. Separate from OCD completely, you're asking me.
Yeah.
I have kids who are in their 20s and, they're just finishing up college and one just graduated. And, my focus there is always, find your passion, find what you love, and make that your life's work. And then you're not really working. I see so many people whose lives are one in which they're chained to work, where they may make a lot of money, but they're very unhappy and very stressed. And to spend so much of your life and of your time engaged in work like that is just, to me, torturous to even think about. But you know what they say, if you love what you work, you never work a day in your life, kind of thing, because you're just engaged in things which you love. And the other thing, in terms of outside of work, is I'm always reminded of that saying that I don't remember where I first heard it, but essentially goes something like, when people are on their deathbed, they never say, "I wish I would have spent more time at work and less time with my family and doing the things that I love to do." It's always the other way around. And so even if you love your work and you're passionate about it, as I am, it's really very important to find life outside of work and get that balance.
Yeah.
My words of wisdom.
Yeah, no, great. Both great pieces of advice. And obviously, that's something I've worked on the last couple of years is knowing when to draw a line on work and go have fun. And what I find doing that, I then come back to work more refreshed and ready to go.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, especially with, work like yours or work like mine, where there isn't a time, you don't punch in and punch out. I mean, I could be working on something at any given time having to do with my practice, whether it's, reading something or writing something or doing therapy or doing something having to do with, the practice. We have, at this point, eight therapists, and so it's really a business. And so there's always something that needs to be done, and knowing, and a lot of the work can be done at home for me. Knowing when to walk away and say, "Okay, I'm done for the day," is really very important.
Yeah, very much so. For your own, for your own mental health, if nothing else.
Absolutely.
Cool. So, let's say in New Jersey, you've got a billboard somewhere in a busy area. What would you have on that billboard for the world to see?
Wow, these are step out of your head kind of questions. I know this sounds corny, but the first thing that really comes to my mind is just like, think love. Because there's just, there's not enough of that. And I think we sometimes lose track, even when we're with every single day the people that we love, we don't pay attention to that. And I think that, expressing that and sharing that, I try to do that a lot with my family. I try to do that a lot with my staff. We had a staff meeting last week, and it's the only time that we're all together in this big room. We discuss cases, we talk about clinical stuff, and, not only do I find myself getting a lot of work done with them and finding myself impressed by how knowledgeable they are and how accomplished they each are in their own way, but we laugh a lot during these meetings. We just have a really good time. And I just spontaneously sent an email to the group, to everybody, like right after the meeting, just saying how I was found myself looking around the room thinking how lucky I am that I'm that I have a situation like this, that I just so thoroughly enjoy and respect the people that I am working with every single day. And so I think, in part of that love is really the appreciation of one's relationships and what one has.
I love that message. And it's great to be in a working environment like that. And as you did, show appreciation for it. Okay, cool. So how can people find out more about you, your book, etc.?
Well, we have a website. It's stressandanxiety.com. The word and is spelled out A-N-D. It isn't that funny, simple thing. And there's no periods, dots, nothing. It's just stressandanxiety.com. There is a little video that describes my book and has a few of the stories, a couple of which I just told there. There's another story, which is really a long story. It's a 15-minute story. And, when I do my storytelling at the International OCD Foundation Conference, I do the whole bit. I get dressed up in my pajamas, and I wear one of those old-style pajama caps with the pom-pom at the end of it. And to give the sense of a kind of a nighttime storytelling event, I either light a candle or I have a laptop that has an app on it that has a fireplace on it, like a Yule log. And I have a hot cup of coffee, a hot cup of cocoa, I mean. And, we get people around, and we used to hand out, like, little baskets of popcorn and stuff. And I would sit down and tell stories. And this video is of me telling the story. I think it's the Bully in the Playground, which talks about OCD as a bully, but in very, very great detail. The stories in the book really aren't about OCD at all. They're really just stories. In the way that I talked about going to the movies before, or going into the swimming pool, they're metaphors. And you look at the dynamics of those stories, and then you can translate them to, the OCD situation, so that the book is written where here's a story, and then here's how it's connected to OCD, here's where it's relevant. But most people don't have to even read, if you have OCD, you don't have to even read the second part. You know what it's talking about. And I also find that when people have stories in their head about certain concepts, it's much more at their fingertips. They remember it more clearly. And therefore, they can utilize the tools and the skills associated with recovery much more effectively. So that's where they're. And there's information about me and all my staff on the website as well. So it's a great place to visit. I encourage you to do so.
Cool. Yeah, I'll put all the links in the show notes for this episode as well. Thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
You're very, very welcome. And thanks for giving me an opportunity to talk about all this, because I love to do that.
Hey, guys. So I hope you found that episode with Alan Wegg interesting. I certainly did. He's a really nice guy. And I found his book really a nice look and a nice angle on approaching treatment in OCD. And it could also be applied for treatment in anything, I believe. It's storytelling is very powerful. It's why I created this website. Before you go, thanks again for listening. Thanks for your support, and have a good week. And maybe try and put some into practice what Alan said, and take care.